In a world where science has gone too far, one man's ambition has created a new breed of terror. On a remote island off the coast of Costa Rica, billionaire entrepreneur John Hammond has created a wildlife park unlike any other. But when a security breach allows the park's genetically engineered dinosaurs to run free, a group of survivors must band together to escape the island before it's too late. Yes. Featuring groundbreaking special effects and an all-star cast including Sam Neill, Laura Dern, and Jeff Goldblum, Jurassic Park will take you on a journey through the ultimate test of survival. Get ready to face your fears and experience the thrill ride of a lifetime. Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Welcome to It's How Old? I'm your host, Mark Asquith, co-founder of the Nerd Podcasts Network, which includes such illustrious podcasts as Spark of Rebellion, the weekly Star Wars podcast. This is the podcast that celebrates pop culture's biggest birthdays, and this episode is a special. It holds a very special place within not only my heart, but I know the heart of my co-host. This is, of course, the Jurassic Park episode, part of season one, which includes other movies that you may have heard of, including Return of the Jedi, The Dark Knight, Superman the movie, and Man of Steel, all celebrating illustrious birthdays in 2023. Now, there is no listening order. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. Don't worry. You've not missed anything. You can listen to this season and all of the other seasons of It's How Old? At your leisure. There is absolutely no right way to listen. Pick a movie that is close to you, or a piece of music, a song, a game, something that you love, and dive in as we travel through time to revisit some of our favorites. Now, the podcast follows a pretty fun little format. We're going to talk about Jurassic Park. We're going to give our first impressions. We're going to take ourselves back to 1993 and discuss our first impressions, our ratings back then as we remember it. We're going to talk about the cast, the high points, the low points, the standout points for both myself and my wonderful co-host. We're going to dig into the music, the special effects, and actually, how well has this movie aged? So without further ado, let's get cracking. I'm going to bring in my fantastic co-host, someone that I've gotten to know over the last few years in my life in podcasting, not only as founder of nerdpodcast.com with Gary Ehlert, but also as co-founder of Captivate, a podcast hosting platform. So welcome to the show. One of my favorite podcasters, a great friend, not only in podcasting, but in life in general. We have the wonderful M. McGowan. Welcome to the show, my wonderful co-host, Em. How are you?
Hello, Mark. I can't believe you full-named me. Oh, my gosh. I never get full-named.
Well, it's the Sunday effect for this episode, you know, Jurassic Park. It's when in Rome.
Wow. Normally I like to think of myself. First of all, thank you for having me. Thank you for the incredible introduction as well. That was awesome. I do like to think of myself as the Beyonce of movie podcasts, and and therefore I never use my full name for podcasting.
Well, I think we can go with that. So we can go with the stage name of M, which I come back. You know, I'm all right with that. I'm all right with that. We'll get some jewelry with it on. You know, we'll get some kind of backstage passes. We'll get all the VIP treatment going. And you're no stranger to podcasting, M. What do you do? Tell us a little bit about what you do in the podcasting space, and just let's get it out up front. Where can people listen to your fantastic show?
Oh, gosh. So I host the podcast Verbal Diorama. It is the podcast all about the history and legacy of movies you know and movies you don't. I do actually have an episode on Jurassic Park. I did it several years ago. So I like to look into film history. I love to look at how stuff's made. This is a movie like Jurassic Park is very much my sort of thing. I'm a huge fan of practical effects. Just as a start off. So when you said to me, do you want to come on my podcast and talk about this particular movie, I was like, absolutely yes, because this is the stuff that I love to talk about. This is basically the bread and butter of what I do. It's talking about how stuff's made. And I've always been fascinated with film history. And in all honesty, my fascination with how a movie is made started with seeing this movie in the cinema. So this is like full circle, you know, full circle situation going on. I can literally talk for Britain. So again, it's why I'm a good podcaster. You can obviously, if anyone wants to find Verbal Diorama, there's 200 plus episodes out there of all sorts of movies. And that's where you can find me. And I'm so psyched to be here, honestly. I don't know if you can tell. I'm just genuinely very excited to be here.
We are picking up on the vibe. I'm sure you, the ever-present listener out there, is picking up on Em's fantastic enthusiasm, not only for podcasting, but for this movie in particular. And I have put a link into the episode notes, into the show notes of this particular episode, to link to your episode of Verbal Diorama, where you discuss Jurassic Park. So if you do want even more Jurassic Park goodness, if you want, honestly, a fantastic movie podcast, go and listen to Verbal Diorama. Now, Let's get into this, all right? 1993. That is an insane 30 years ago, and it freaks me out. And it's actually why this podcast was born. If anyone's listened to the trailer out there, you'll know that this is sort of, why I created this podcast, because constantly it freaks me out how old things are, and honestly, how old I am. But 1993, early 90s, it still felt a little bit 80s. You know, I was probably 9 years old, 10 years old, 11 years old. I can't remember. I was like 10, 11 years old. We were wearing big baggy jeans. You know, I was still collecting stickers out of cereal boxes. And I was just in the throes of finding my own version of geekdom. You know, there were things like Batman that had been out just a few years prior to that. And It was for me, it was a very formative time, but the world was a very different place. There wasn't really any internet. There was no way. We were still reading magazines, and we were still sending letters into comic books and all the things. We were watching Games Master and trying to record the cheat codes of the end credits. So it was a very, very different time. And I remember it vividly, this movie coming out. And what were you like in 93? Let's just add a little bit of context. Like, what was going on with you in 93?
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, I can't believe I went to the cinema and saw this movie when I hadn't even been conceived yet. I'm joking.
No, I meant to say same.
I was probably maybe about 11, I think, when this movie came out. I'm trying to think back. Yeah, I would have been 11. Crikey, oh my God, I'm giving away how old I am.
I know, right? We've got to dodge that. We should not mention any dates anymore. It undoes the entire premise of the podcast, but it protects us.
Yeah. Literally, before we started recording, I joked about dinosaur in the room, and now I feel like that's coming true.
I feel like we're exactly the same age, to be honest. I'm like, I'm M82. I'm not, you know, and I'm getting from that you're around the same. So I'm with you on this one. Everything's a bit creepy.
A little bit older. My real main issue, I think, is my I have very sporadic memories of my childhood. And the reason for that is I basically had some medical things going on at the time, and it's kind of impaired my memory a little bit. But the interesting thing is, while I can't remember a lot of the things that were kind of happening around that time in my life, I will always remember Jurassic Park. I always remember the experience of Jurassic Park. And to be honest, I was a hugely nerdy kid. So I spent a lot of time like playing video games when I was a kid. I loved Games Master. Games Master was the best. So while I can't honestly pinpoint a moment and say I definitely dressed like that, or I was definitely doing that at that time, because honestly, my memory is just so sketchy from back then. But Jurassic Park always, always stands out. And it is genuinely that formative. Out of everything that I've forgotten about that period in my life. And there's a lot that I've forgotten. Like, people come up to me and they go, oh, we went to school together when we were like 11. And I was like, did we? Because I genuinely don't remember. But Jurassic Park is just, it's just so memorable. The experience of going to see this movie just never, ever escaped my brain. That's how important this movie was. So I have genuinely been trying to think, you know, what was I doing? You know, and honestly, my memory is so bad that it's really struggling. But I was probably the biggest, nerdiest girl. Because I always remember being very different to girls my age, because girls my age, they were, you know, into like Just 17 magazine and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, teeny bopper bands. And I was kind of into that. I do remember being into Boyzone at some point. But yeah, terrible taste in music.
Hey, we were all into Boyzone. They had their own specific brand of goodness. Oh, those pop tunes.
Oh, God.
Those pop tunes.
I mean,
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because it's such, obviously it's a big inflection point for you, which I'll get to in a second, but it felt like Jurassic Park to me. And I think the way that I sort of look back on this myself is it felt like a change to the world of movies. You know, this, one of the things I like to talk about in this season, and in particular this podcast, is that, you know, what is the impact of it on you, which I think is clearly profound. And the same with me, it was sort of an eye opener. It was the word that you used, the experience, not only the cinema, but the music, and even things like, for me, it's the first movie that I remember coming out, apart from maybe Batman, where I wanted to collect other things. Now I'm a huge collector of things. I've got a full, you know, man cave full of geek stuff. But this for me was maybe the second movie where I was like, actually, I'm going to collect the stickers. I'm going to collect such and such. And I'm going to get, you know, the drinks holders and the lunch. But I want to collect these things. So when you think about the impact on you and I, is it fair to say, in your opinion, that this movie really, it was a seminal thing, not just for us, but for movies, wasn't it? It felt like that big a deal. Like, I don't know if I'm overstating that.
No, I genuinely don't think you are. And I think that, you know, I think a lot of people have that feeling about Jurassic Park in particular, especially people of our generation, you know, the millennial generation. You know, this was the movie. This was the movie that introduced us to the power of cinema. You know, and arguably, you know, you could say the same about Batman a few years before as well. I wasn't really kind of, I'm more into Marvel anyway, so I've never been like hugely into DC. So Batman kind of passed me by a little bit. It wasn't like, I know, because Batman was a huge phenomenon back in 89, but that kind of passed me by a little bit. Jurassic Park was really the one for me. And, you know, just sort of talking about, you know, how seminal it was. I've always been quite open about the reasons why I started Verbal Diorama. And it was basically, essentially, that my love of cinema came from my grandparents. My grandparents took me to see this movie. And my grandparents, I don't think they fully realised that it was as scary as it was when they took me and my brother to see this movie. But Verbal Diorama actually started as more or less a tribute to my granddad, you know, after he passed away. And it was a promise that I made to him that I was going to do this podcast. So again, it's all kind of full circle. You know, he started my love for cinema by taking me to see Jurassic Park. And then, you know, now I have this podcast and I talk about movies like Jurassic Park all the time. And it's just funny how the world works sometimes. But I traced everything back to Jurassic Park in some weird way.
Oh, I love that, though. And it's nice when you can revisit the thing that really started your passion, you know, and was the catalyst for you taking action with that. I can certainly relate to that. And let's cast our minds back then. I want to really specifically do two things. I want to get a really short sort of almost like a gut answer to the next set of questions. All right. I'm just going to ask you two things and I want to get the sort of gut answer, and then I'll give mine as well. And we'll see where we end up. So the first thing, What was your initial one sentence first impression when you first saw Jurassic Park?
I was absolutely petrified of it. Mm-hmm. And yet I absolutely loved it instantly.
I love that. I love that. I get that.
Throughout my whole life, I've never been a fan of horror. And even now on the podcast, I'm always like, oh, if it's a horror movie, then I'm not really going to like it. I do like some horror. But this movie genuinely frightened me. And this is why, like, my grandparents, I don't think they genuinely thought it was. They just thought they were taking their grandchildren to a fun dinosaur movie, you know, like the Flintstones or something. I was genuinely terrified, but I loved it regardless.
Love that. And I can, again, completely relate to that. My first impression is very, very similar. It was very much a shock and awe scenario for me. There was a lot. I'm a very musical person, and music drives me, which we'll get to later, I'm sure, because it's an absolute standout piece. You know, it's very, very famous, the entire Jurassic Park suite. So for me, it was the shock and awe of the music, the visuals. Wow, a dinosaur. And then, oh my, right, okay, that's a dinosaur that's actually chasing this guy. So yeah, shock and awe completely for me. All right. What we do, we like to do some ratings. All right, we do some ratings as you were, if you like. So what would you have rated this on the day that you first saw it? And then at the end of the show, we're going to come back to the ratings after we've discussed it a little bit. After, of course, we've both rewatched this in preparation for this episode. And we're going to discuss whether or not that rating has changed. So out of 10, what would you have rated Jurassic Park the first time you ever saw it back in 1993?
See, this was a really difficult question because I was like, as an 11-year-old, like, I don't know, I was not very movie savvy. Going to the cinema was a very rare thing for me as a child. You know, we watched a lot of Disney VHS tapes, you know. So
same. Same. So, love it.
I think back then, had you asked 11-year-old nerdy me, I would probably have said something along the lines of maybe like an 8 out of 10, just for like the amazing value of, oh my God, there's a dinosaur on the screen. This is terrific. Mm-hmm. But then I would probably go, it was a bit too scary for me. I think that's what I would have said back then.
So that's interesting. All right.
I think that's what I would have done because I can't in all honesty say that 11-year-old me was savvy enough to go to see the brilliance and go, yeah, 10 out of 10. Because the experience of watching this movie has just kind of resonated over time. It's always something that I always come back to and I always think about. But I don't think I fully appreciated it back then. I was just, I'm going out with my grandparents for the day. You know, because I was 11.
Yeah, maybe ranking the experience, which to be fair, I think as a moviegoer and someone that hits a theatre and hits a cinema, I don't mind that as such as a rating because I think that is part of it. You know, we if we look back at COVID and the pandemic, that movie going experience was removed for so many people, and the movies, you know, there's a reason Top Gun Maverick wasn't released during that time, you know? So I do get that. I do completely buy that. And do you know what? I would have gone 9 and mainly because of the music. And like I said, the awe side of things, the whole, I mind horror a little bit less I would have thought of Jurassic Park as horror until I was a little bit older and sort of saw it for some of the elements that it had inside it. So I would have been very similar. I'd have gone with a 9, but I'm, do you know what? Now you said it, I think I agree with you that it would be the experience of watching Jurassic Park as opposed to just the movie. So that'll be interesting later to see whether or not that, I suppose whether or not that affects our ratings, you know, because we're, I don't want to say it, but we have got a little bit older, you know? We have got a little bit older, so will that affect
30
things?
Years on those days.
Just,
oh my God.
You know, whatever, 10, 15 at best. Now, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's look at this cast, because this is a heck of a cast. You know, when we look at some of the people that played supporting roles, all right? We've got Wayne Knight, who played Nedry. He's popped up in so many things. We've got people like Samuel L. Jackson in a bit of a breakout role. We've got, of course, people like Bob Peck. We've got Richard Attenborough. But the big three, the people that people remember, that we all remember, of course, are the fantastic Sam Neill, the wonderful Laura Dern, and the irreplaceable Jeff Goldblum. Now, this cast alone is strong. You know, in a movie in 1993 that was, yes, a Steven Spielberg movie, it was a big cast back then. And it says something that obviously, you know, Sam L. Jackson is not a headline at this point. And yet you've still got all of this star power. What do you make of the cast? You know, the casting now, looking back, is that still as great as it felt when you were a kid?
I think that what Spielberg did with this cast was fascinating to me, because this, you know, Jurassic Park was obviously a huge Michael Crichton book. And normally when you're adapting something like this, you would automatically go for, you know, the big players in Hollywood, you would think, because you'd be like, well, you know, we want people to see this movie. Let's get Arnold Schwarzenegger involved, because, you know, why not? Because he's, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's just been in Terminator 2 Judgment Day. You know, he's huge in Hollywood. And because when you look at this cast back then, obviously they were known names, but they weren't anything like the stars that they are now. And it's almost like sometimes the best movies take actors that are, you know, the names are known enough, but not really that well known, and just kind of push them into the stratosphere. And I feel like this movie did that for so many people. I mean, you've obviously mentioned Samuel L. Jackson. You know, his role is small in this movie, but he is absolutely vital. One of the things that I love about this movie and about this cast and everyone in it is not only is the cast absolutely pitch perfect, you know, if you look at the characters and the individual arcs of each character, everyone seems to be perfectly cast. You know, you expect Sam Neill to be a little bit cautious, maybe. You know, you expect Laura Dern to be a little bit more optimistic. And then you expect Jeff Goldblum to literally be the sexual energy in the room. And, you know, Jeff Goldblum in this movie is everything. You know, he is the meme of him lying shirtless on the table, you know.
He is the unapologetic version of Jeff Goldblum, isn't he? That was, for me, that was the genius casting.
And I don't,
this is so cliched, but like, honestly, as a kid, I'm just like, this is a funny, kooky guy. Look how he talks. This is fantastic. And he does all this. Look, he is so suave and smooth. And my mum's like, that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, What a fantastic multifaceted bit of casting.
And also as well, like, I mean, obviously this is an attractive cast, but these aren't a cast of supermodels. You know, these look like regular, everyday people. You know, these could be scientists. Mm. They could be paleontologists. They could be chaos mathematicians. You know, I mean, I'd love to meet a chaos mathematician who looks like Jeff Goldblum.
Oh, that's the dream. That's the dream.
Always the dream. But they feel like real people. They don't feel like characters. They feel like real people doing real things. And they feel like they react in the absolute most real way that you could in a scenario where you're seeing a dinosaur for the first time. It still blows my mind. You know, the fact that they sell it every single time, even though you see this movie 1,000 times and they still sell that moment where they see the dinosaurs for the first time.
Yeah, they really do. And that's such an important, I think, an important thing to consider, because we're going to get to the standout moments. And inevitably, that is one of them, I think, for everyone. But I think when you actually start to put together that the effects that they were working with were significantly less commonplace than they are now. So the experience of people working in the environment was so much different, and yet they still delivered a performance that you believe. Now, what's interesting, you mentioned this sort of sleeper casting, if you like, this casting where everyone is just big enough to be big enough, but not superstar status. You know, they're not, like you said, they're not the kind of A-listers. And very often that is what helps a movie, just like it helped Superman the movie back in 78. And just, let's just, some of these names, all right, these are some names that are picked from the top 20 highest grossing actors of the year in 93, all right? So we have Wesley Snipes, Julia Roberts, Whoopi Goldberg, Kevin Costner, Tom Hanks, Sly Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Harrison Ford, Tom Cruise, Jodie Foster, Nicole Kidman, Clint Eastwood, Demi Moore, and Jean-Claude Van Damme. Now, that is a clear, to me, that's a clear cross-section of... I was going to say A-list, but then I thought, well, Jean-Claude's in there, so we'll say, you know, we'll say movie stars. I love Jean-Claude Van Damme,
no,
but is he A-list? Was he ever A-list? Yeah, I know, right? I mean, he sold a lot of VHS. God bless Universal Soldier. So, I mean, that they're the typical stars that you're right. If you're Spielberg or if you expect a movie of this billing, because it got billed as an epic, as a movie that was going to change things. And that's a risk on the cast, isn't it? You know, how is it the dinosaurs? Is it the promise that draws people into the box office when the cast is not quite A-list? I'm not sure. How do you analyze that? How do you think about that?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, the tagline for this movie, you know, with that epic poster, you know, I've actually got it in my house, the black with the red and the T-Rex logo and an adventure 65 million years in the making. And that's it. That's your tagline. And it's one of the most genius posters. And it kind of irks me a little bit because I feel like Hollywood's lost the art of poster making. You know, if you look at movie posters today where you've got floating heads, can you imagine a Jurassic Park poster with Sam Neill's floating head, Laura Dern's floating head, and Jeff Goldblum's floating head?
Well, actually, that's a great point. Sorry to interject, but I was in my head then, I was going through like all of the people that would be on that poster. And you're right, you know, Sam Neill, Laura Dern, and then you'd have Jeff Goldblum. And then my brain started then going to, well, actually, was Jeff Goldblum big enough? Like that was where my thought went. And then I started thinking Independence Day. And thinking, hang on, was he on the poster for ID before? And he wasn't. It was, again, another well-designed classic movie poster.
Great poster.
Isn't it just? And it's a real great point. I remember, you know, one of my design and tech projects at school when I was 16, 15, so just a few years after this, was to design a movie poster. And I'm no artist, but I designed... like an old school poster, you know, here's an island in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, a lot of stuff in the background, a lot of stuff in the foreground. And there wasn't a person on it. And you've just made me think about that, thinking about Jurassic Park. Now, let's talk about that design, the logo, because that has stood the test of time. You know, granted, nostalgia plays a part. We've all got T-shirts and so on and so forth. I was in Brighton recently. And someone had a Jurassic Park Jeep kitted out like Jurassic Park Jeep with the logo on the side. Like, that is timeless and instantly recognizable, isn't it? They did such a great job on that.
Yeah. And it's like, it's funny because the movie actually kind of, you know, it's kind of lampooning itself in a way because they mention in the movie about merchandising, you know, we want this logo on lunchboxes and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And, you know, in the gift shop and all of that. And it's almost like this lost art of movie advertising to have that one iconic logo. The only other one that kind of springs immediately to mind is Alien with the poster with the egg. And it's just that one iconic image that just sells the entire premise in one image. And to me, this logo sells the premise of a theme park. I know it's weird because, like you say, you're talking about nostalgia and, you know, everyone on Earth pretty much knows Jurassic Park. I don't think anyone would not know what Jurassic Park is. It's that ubiquitous in pop culture. But it's kind of... it's bled through not just this movie and its sequels and you know, the franchise as a whole, but from this one simple logo with with a T-Rex on it. One of the things, I don't know if you ever, if you caught the most recent movie, Dominion.
I did, sadly.
Well, one of the things about that movie that kind of irked me a little bit was they were constantly trying to pinpoint certain certain reference points from the first movie. So they'd have certain scenes that referenced it. And then you had the scene where you had the T-Rex and it was framed with the circle. And just, I mean, I liked it. I thought it looked good and it was a nice callback. But I think the problem with those movies is they're trying too hard to be this movie, because this movie sets such a standard that none of the sequels and spin-offs and, you know, nothing can match the genius of this movie. And that's why we're still talking about it 30 years later. And in 30 years' time, we're not going to be talking about Jurassic World Dominion. I'm sorry, but we're just not.
No, that is absolutely true, which actually leads me on to an interesting section of the episode, which I want to get into a little bit, because for me, this movie, certainly in this season of It's How Old, this occupies a unique spot amongst the other episodes and the other movies that we've covered, which I'll talk to you about in a second. So I want to talk about the high points and the real low points for you. And I'm gonna just set my stall out on this one. Okay, there are a couple of real standout high points, not only visually and as part of the story, but just generally across the movie experience for me. Obviously, the design, obviously. But the big ones for me were, like I said, the music, which we'll spend a little bit of time on in a while, but the music was a real high point. But from a story and a movie perspective, we've already talked about it. The first glimpse of the dinosaurs is just, it is, for me, it's one of the ultimate movie high points that there's ever been and that there will ever be. There's a couple more other high points in there. Obviously, the T-Rex, the kind of, just the general spectacle of the T-Rex, the way that was done, and the way that it was starkly contrasted against the way the velociraptors are and the way that they act. That was another high point for me. I thought that was really well done. But just that overall scene, the first, I suppose, delivery of the dinosaurs has to be a high point. What about you? What are the standouts for you?
I mean, there's so many. there's
I is it the that is one big pile of shit.
I mean, you know, there's, as I said, like at the start of this episode, I'm a huge fan of practical effects. So this movie for me, with the blend, and it is seamless, this seamless blend of CG and practical effects. One of the things that sort of annoys me a little bit is when people will compare movies from the early 2000s. We all know early 2000s CG is pretty duff. On occasion, there are some lovely examples of early 2000 CG and late 90s CG that really doesn't stand up well to a modern lens.
All of the Star Wars prequels.
I mean, I wasn't going to say anything, Mark, because I feel like it's a touchy subject for you. But
hey, I love the prequels for the stories, but oh my word.
A lot of people will point to something like Jurassic Park and say, oh, well, that movie that came out in 98's got really bad CG, but look at Jurassic Park. That came out in 93. Look how good their CG is. And to that, I always kind of say, well, yes, the CG is exemplary in this movie. This movie had, this was like the foundation of CG pretty much in this movie, is what you see on screen is cutting edge stuff. But also I kind of always argue the point that there's more practical work in this movie than people think. There's not as much CG in this movie as people think. Because the practical work, the puppets, the animatronics are so good that people think they're CG. Because I think people's eyes nowadays are kind of trained to kind of spot CG in movies. Something always says to me that when someone sees something like a good animatronic puppet, they instantly think, oh, that must be CG because it looks really good. But there's so much excellent puppet work in this movie. It's all Stan Winston, the legendary Stan Winston Studios, Phil Tippett as well. Their work goes back to like the late 70s, early 80s. You know, if you're talking about like practical work, practical effects work, visual effects, puppetry in Hollywood, you go to the legendary Stan Winston. And these are some of the most incredible puppets that you will ever see on screen. And they are genuinely huge as well. They had so many problems. A bit going back to like Steven Spielberg, going back to Jaws, everyone knows Bruce the Shark. There were a lot of problems with that animatronic in the water. Everyone knows the stories about Bruce. But very few people know the stories about the problems they had with the T-Rex on this movie, where the T-Rex in the rain was like the foam was expanding. So the puppet was basically blowing up because it was absorbing all this water. And just really incredible stories from how they made this movie. And then you kind of think, well, Spielberg, bless his cotton socks, you know, he did one monster movie, did great. You know, he did Jaws. Jaws is basically one of the greatest creature movies of all time. And then he thought, yeah, do you know what? I'm going to do another and it's going to go fine. And we're like, Steven, did you not learn from Jaws? You know, but honestly, the standouts, mainly for me, would be anything to do with any animatronic dinosaur on screen. You know, I love the clever girl scene, you know, for example.
Oh, genius. Absolutely. And the delivery of it,
the
way that it's, yeah, and the way that Bob Peck just looks, it's almost a resignation in his delivery, in his eyes, but also the pride.
Yeah. You know,
it's the nuance just on in that one line, and it's become, obviously it's become a little bit of a meme, and people sort of say it generally, you know, for varying reasons, but just when you look at it in the context of the movie, the delivery and everything is just so well executed. It really, really isn't. Let's spend a little bit of time on the SFX, on the special effects, because I think this warrants a little bit of a couple of minutes sort of digging into, because you said something there that was fascinating to me. You know, there was such a big mix of practical and CG, and I think that is, you know, in order for things to get better, they have to get a little bit worse as we try and we figure out what doesn't work. So, you know, 6 years later, 1999, The Phantom Menace, it's a lot of CG, all right? It's all CG. And fine, it was the best we had at the time. It had to get a little bit worse before it got better. But that really suffered and is suffering today with purely the overuse, you know, purely the overuse of CG in that movie. When we look back at 93 and you look back at 91, Terminator 2.
Yep.
And I, you know, I wouldn't even go, maybe go back as far as like 84 with Terminator, but certainly 91. The things that Jurassic Park and T2 get right is exactly what you mentioned. It's that blend of practical and CG. And it's to be admired and commended, I think, the ability to know when to do something and when, just because you can, doesn't mean you should.
Which is, yay! You set the line!
There you go. You're welcome. You're welcome. So it's, but I think the special effects, you know, we lived in that golden era. You look at T2.
Yeah.
That still stands up. Yeah, granted, maybe not quite as good as Jurassic Park when it comes to the effects, but it's still pretty good for a 30-odd-year-old movie.
I think Terminator 2 Judgment Day, it's absolutely phenomenal filmmaking. And I think
it's one of the greatest movies, isn't it?
I mean, between them, Cameron and Spielberg, you know, they are, I mean, for millennials, we grew up on Cameron and Spielberg, pretty much, you know. And yeah,
true, actually.
I mean, obviously, a lot of Cameron's early stuff, you know, like Aliens and especially, well, The Terminator I wasn't allowed to watch. I watched Terminator 2 before I watched The Terminator because it scared me. But, you know, this was the stuff that we grew up on. And I think sometimes now we look at Cameron especially, and I think some of the times people kind of consider him a bit of a laughing stock because, oh, he's gone off to Pandora again. You know, he's doing 600 Avatar movies. But to me, the James Cameron really shaped cinema in so many ways, you know, and pair him with someone like Spielberg, who was, you know, think of all the amazing movies that Steven Spielberg's done that, you know, that that people are still watching today and still loving today. And it's one of those things that I don't think people fully appreciate the majesty of the collective work of Steven Spielberg, especially like the, I'm going to say in inverted commas, the youth, because, you know, they'll see Steven Spielberg and they'll go, oh, you know, he's just some old dude who, you know, maybe did a couple of big films. It's like, no, look at the catalogue of Steven Spielberg, man. You know, look at
what. I think it's because it was, you're right, absolutely. Sorry to jump in. It was so formative for us, but it's also so formative. I think it's like a couple of generations that Spielberg has shaped across the board. And I would not disagree with that. Now, in just a second, I'm going to actually just reveal why this movie stands out to me amongst all of the other movies that we've covered in this season. There's one big reason for me, and I'm going to see if you agree, Em. But before I do that, I'm going to tell you a little bit about this.
Hello there.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Spark of Rebellion.
If you are enjoying this episode, I have absolutely no doubt that you will love our sister show, Spark of Rebellion. With news, views, and a little bit of comedy, it is your weekly dose of everything Star Wars. And it's intended to keep busy people like you and I up to date with everything happening in a galaxy far, far away. Of course, it's available in your podcast app of choice or at sparkofrebellion.com. All right. Why does this movie stand out amongst all of the other movies that we've covered in this season? Well, Em, I don't know if you agree with this, but there's one big reason for me. And on my floor here, I have it to discuss the low points of this movie. Now, out of Return of the Jedi, The Dark Knight, Superman the movie, Man of Steel, and Jurassic Park, this is the only movie for me that I legitimately have racked my brains for a long, long time trying to find a low point, something that I did not like. And it's the only movie that I cannot find a single thing that I don't like. How do you feel about that? Is there anything you don't like?
There is nothing that I don't like about this movie. I feel like you could, with the hindsight of 30 years of experience in life, shall we say, you could, if you really wanted to, you could pull apart this movie because of, you know, factual-based reasons, the science, for example, you know. But at the end of the day, this is science fiction. You know, this isn't science fact. You know, no one's saying that you could find some amber somewhere and then create your own dinosaur. I'm sure that scientists are trying. I heard that they were trying to resurrect dodos. I don't know whether they've managed that yet. But
do not want to be doing that. Do not mess with this.
I mean, if you're going to do it, start with a dodo instead of a velociraptor.
You say that, they'll get it wrong. They'll be like 32 foot tall dodos. We're all done for.
I mean, you I'm know, out. The apocalypse is coming.
<I'm out. laughs> <It's just> one dodo at a time.
One dodo at a time, yeah. I think you, if you really wanted to, you could pull this movie apart for whatever reason, but no one wants to. And the reason no one wants to is because this movie is genuinely the perfect cinematic experience. And not just a cinematic experience. It's just the perfect movie you could just put on. You could put it on for the family. You could put it on with a date. You could put it on with your grandparents, like, you know, what I did. You know, and it's kind of the perfect movie for really any situation. If you think about it, there's nothing in this movie that's okay. You can't watch it with maybe a 4-year-old because it is a little bit scary in places. But otherwise, this is kind of the perfect family movie experience. This is why we go to the cinema, to see movies like this, to see movies with these amazing effects, to see movies with actually things that make you think. It makes you think about the ethics of what they're doing, the implications of genetic engineering. And then it also kind of makes you think about going back to Terminator 2 in a little bit, the reliance on technology. And what are we doing relying on technology? Why are we messing with things? Why is humanity always messing with everything? You know, that's where Skynet comes from, let's be honest. And there's just so much to love in this movie. Sorry if I'm waffling on a little bit, but, you know, I just...
Hey, that's why you're here.
it is. But, you know, you asked if there was a low point. I genuinely don't think there is.
No, I agree, and I'm just looking back over the list again. You know, looking at and we'll probably get to this later when we re-rate. But I can't find another movie, certainly from this season, that I don't feel so. I suppose, well, I can't find another movie that I feel so fulfilled by. And this is coming from like the world's biggest Superman fan. We're reviewing and retro reviewing and revisiting two Superman movies, a Batman movie, and a Star Wars movie. And I am a DC guy and a Star Wars guy. And I can find something that I don't like about all of those. So I think that really is testament to just how this stands up. Yeah, of course it's nostalgic. Of course. But that's why we're here. That's why this show exists. And I think that's all right sometimes. You know, we can see things through the lens that we saw things when we were first stood there in shock and awe at the dinosaurs for the first time. Now, as we head back to the gift shop and pick up our Jurassic Park branded rulers, we are going to take this home in just a few minutes. But I want to spend a little bit of time just before we get to how this movie has aged and just whether we would tweak our ratings as of today. Before we get to that, I want to spend just a few minutes on the music, the very famous Jurassic Park suite, obviously composed by the irreplaceable John Williams. For me, absolute legend. John Williams, Hans Zimmer are the top two for me. Obviously, people like Giacchino. We've got people like Silvestri. We've got more modern people like Ludwig Göransson. All outstanding composers. But for me, the top two, John Williams, Hans Zimmer, there are no better. And I think it will be a struggle to ever find better. Ironically, as well, I didn't notice this, all of the five movies in this season have been scored by John Williams and Hans Zimmer. So, well done me for the bias. Well done.
It was like subconscious bias. It was like you weren't even thinking, but then you were like, I just want John Williams and Hans Zimmer and that's it.
Put them on the show. Now, hey, look, I love the music. It's a real, the main theme, you know, is a real earworm. It's one of those that you will never get it out of your head. The whole suite is wonderful. It can be played on anything and still sound outstanding, and it is instantly recognizable. Music is a huge part of my life. You'll hear it on the Superman episodes. It's a huge, huge deal for me. How do you feel about the music here? Not only John Williams, we know he's a legend and I know you love him, but just this specific piece of music, the suite of Jurassic Park, the composition, how do you feel about it?
I think it perfectly encapsulates that awe and wonder. You know, you were saying earlier about the shock and awe of seeing a dinosaur. You know, as soon as that John Williams score comes into the movie, it just automatically fills you with that sense of wonder. And, you know, what am I going to see next? What else is going to be happening on screen? And it's just got this amazing ability to really kind of hype up, if you know what I mean. And just, you know, when the score is playing and they're in the helicopter and you're traveling over this like beautiful, lush, green island, and it's just this builds up this sense of what are you going to find on this island? And I honestly, I mean, you've hit the nail on the head with regards to John Williams. He's scored some of the most iconic movies of all time, and every single one is different. You know, every single one perfectly summarizes that movie, and then you go away and then you hear the score and then you're just instantly transported back. You know, whenever I hear this score, I'm instantly transported to Isla Nublar. Instantly, you know, I know where I am, I know who I'm with, I know what I'm going to see. And the other thing as well, and I don't know if you get this or maybe it's just me, but I've seen this movie countless times, but every single time, and it is the score that does this, because music is that powerful. But before something happens, even though I know it's going to happen. I feel the, oh my God, something's going to happen because the music's telling me it's going to happen, even though I know it's going to happen. And then, you know, just that cathartic release sort of through the music that John Williams does so terrifically through all of his movies. But I think especially this, because this is a very tense movie in places, you know, when Ellie is putting the power on, and she's obviously having to run into the power station with, this is just after the Clever Girl scene. And it's just, the music is just so tense and so dramatic. And it's like, just run, Ellie, run. And I feel like I'm saying that every single time. I'm like, run, just run. And I know that she's going to be fine. But the music is kind of, it fuels this dramatic tension. I'd absolutely love. And then this sweeping score with the, you know, the main theme, I just adore it. I can't say enough wonderful things about this movie, seriously.
Well, that actually leads me on to the next section, just to kind of lead out the show, because I think often we can look through the nostalgic lens, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's a great place to be, and that's why, like I said, this show exists, because of that. We want to celebrate pop culture's biggest birthdays and look back on these things fondly. And as you get older, you know, here's looking at you, Back to the Future 2, things aren't always as good as you remember. It's still a great movie, Back to the Future 2, don't get me wrong, but it ain't as good as 1. And as a kid, 2 was the one that stood out because it was cool and trendy. And the point that I'm getting to is that we sometimes see things differently as we get older. So to you, Em, how has this movie aged? And what is your rating of this movie after your most recent rewatch? If that was the first time that you'd seen Jurassic Park through the eyes of you today, what would you rate it?
I mean, this movie has aged like a fine wine. I feel like this is a movie that's only ever going to get better with age. I feel like, you know, we're going to be in another 30 years celebrating this movie for just how genius it is, how perfectly paced it is, Spielberg's framing of the camera. Also, I didn't even mention the female imagery in this movie, the fact that you have Ellie Sattler, who's one of the greatest female characters ever put to screen, the dinosaurs being female. I love all that stuff. That is very much my jam. I genuinely think it's timeless. It genuinely timeless. I feel like I've literally just put an episode out on The Wizard of Oz, and The Wizard of Oz is timeless. You know, you look at that movie and you go, this movie could have been made 15 years ago. You know, genuinely is that good. I feel like Jurassic Park is up there. I feel like The Wizard of Oz is 84 years old now. I feel like when this is 84, people are still going to be celebrating it. That is the true hallmark of a timeless cinematic experience. And this movie is perfect. This movie is a 10 out of 10 movie. It just is. Everything about this movie is perfect.
I love that. I love that. And I would completely agree with all of that. And I would, if I was doing the same thing, I would probably stick with a 9 out of 10, but only. Well, but that's on me though. And it's not because of the movie. It's on me. Because I'm always weird about giving 10s, because it's like, well, yeah, but there might be something better in the future. But I do think you've talked me into it, because as I'm saying that, and as I'm thinking about it, I'm like, well, why? What would be better than Jurassic Park? Like I said earlier on, the fulfillment that you get from watching this movie never dissipates. It is always that good. This has been Jurassic Park. 30 years since we visited that wonderful, wonderful island of thrills, mystery, and danger. If you've enjoyed this, then please, please, please do check out the other episodes in this season and in this entire podcast. There is no specific listening order. Just pick something that you love and take that traveling time capsule with us as we just go and revisit some of pop culture's finest moments. Thank you so very much for joining me. Before we sign off, give us it one more time. where can people find your fantastic, fantastic podcast?
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. I could talk about this for another hour or two or three easily. It's been a genuine delight to be here with you. People can find me at Verbal Diorama on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. My website is verbaldiorama.com. And yeah, Verbal Diorama, you can find it in your podcast app of choice. Go on, have a listen.
A huge thank you to my fantastic co-host, Em. This has been Jurassic Park. Inside your podcast app of choice or at itshowold.com/listen, you will find episodes covering Man of Steel, Return of the Jedi, The Dark Knight, and Superman the Movie. Thank you for listening. It's always a real pleasure. I've been Mark Asquith. And remember, just keep on loving what you love.